And you mentioned on that call that this was your first film book, and so I wanted to know what led you into Hollywood writing in that regard, or writing about Hollywood.
Well, I didn't know anything about Hollywood, and so it was an act of hubris to a large extent. And I was actually, I came into it as a biographer. I came to the movies through the men rather than being a film critic or a film professor or someone who was steeped in this material and coming to the man through his movies. I was the opposite. I was interested in these very complicated, somewhat tortured men, and then the movies came out of that, and what they made of their lives, and these movies that they left behind, and the fact that each one of them left such an iconic movie. So it was, I mean, the brothers were interesting to me in that way.
And
So
go ahead.
go ahead.
No, I was going to
No,
say
well, I was going to
the
say Herman. I came to the specific brothers through Herman. I started with Herman, and then in researching Herman, read Joe's biography. They each had a biography in 1978, and when I read about Joe, I thought, the sum of the parts, the two brothers together, would be more interesting than either one individually.
Yeah, because they hadn't had a duo biography, and of course this
Right.
is, very much, and it's not just their biography too, but it's their interaction with their father, I think, which is really a key early part of their story as well.
Yes, and I mean, lots of people joke with their siblings that they must have grown up in different families, but Herman and Joe were 11 and a half years apart, and there were tremendous changes in their family circumstances in that 11 and a half years. So they really did grow up with different parents and in different families, and it affected each of them a lot. So that father figure was key, and I actually thought, as a good feminist, I was going to uncover the importance of the mother. I felt all these people who've written about him are men, and they're not paying any attention to the mother, and I'm going to make this great discovery. And guess what? It's the father. The father is really key to understanding them.
And he didn't really want them to be going into the business that they did.
Oh, that's an understatement. He was a German immigrant. He was born in 1872, came over in 1891, was very harsh. He was very cruel to Herman, actually. And he eventually became a teacher of high school and then college. He taught education. He taught pedagogy, if that's the right way to say it. And he thought that was the highest calling anyone could have, to teach young people and to introduce them to the life of the mind. And he wanted Herman to do that, and Herman really didn't want to do that. He was a very political and historically minded person and a journalist, but he also loved theater and was involved in playwriting even from college at Columbia. So he disappointed his father, but he was in New York writing theater criticism and theater reporting and writing plays with George S. Kaufman and Mark Connelly. And then he became the first theater critic for the New Yorker. So he had a life that he loved. And at that point in time, which is the 1920s, movies were looked down upon. Theater was considered art. Not all of it was high art, but it was a very respectable avenue to pursue as an artist and a creative person, whereas movies started as Nickelodeons, and they were regarded as low, not even a medium that you would want to go into. But the money was great, and that's what pulled him out there. He had an alcohol problem, Herman had a gambling problem, and he went out there to make a little money to pay off a debt, and the golden handcuffs engulfed him, and he spent the rest of his life writing for the movies.
Yeah, it's interesting that they still refer to it in the trade publications as the legit theater, right?
Right. Yeah, I never thought about that. That's a good point. So were movies the illegit theater?
Yeah, that's right. And with both of them too, I mean, I once heard a quote on one of my DVDs about in reference to Joe Mankiewicz, that he was too Hollywood for New York and too New York for Hollywood when it
Yes,
comes
Andrew
to.
Serra said that. Yeah, I know. And it's not inaccurate, I would say. His movies are very play-like. they're like theater. They don't really take into account all the things one can do with cinema. You know, there's not all these weird shots and things like that. They're often pretty much interior. And when they're like A Letter to Three Wives, there's a couple of tiny scenes that take place outside, but they could be plays. And that was Joe's orientation, and he succeeded in leaving Hollywood at the peak of his career and coming back to New York to write for theater, but he never did. He was always a creature of Hollywood. There were a number of sort of personal psychological reasons I think it didn't happen, but it didn't.
Yeah, just as an aside, I was what rewatching part of All About Eve this weekend, and it's interesting though that there are some things that he does in the picture that are definitely theatrical, where he lines people up in a certain way on screen that you just don't do that on stage, you know. I mean, the famous shot of them all sitting on the staircase, you know, where they're at that party. I mean, it's just not how people sit.
Yeah, no, it's and people laugh that this is his love letter to the theater. And do theater people really talk like that? Well, no, they don't talk like they're in The Importance of Being Earnest either, but it's wonderful dialogue and you can enjoy it for what it is.
I mean, you mentioned, of course, that both Joseph and Herman were far apart in age, of course, and that it seemed like that they were, you know, raised almost by different parents. But as they, you know, traversed their careers, what was Herman's relationship like with Joe? Even though he was the older one, it seemed that Joe was probably more. You know, with Herman's problems, Joe was the one that would be, you'd think would be looking after Herman. Was that,
Well, yeah, it was really complicated, and it's one of the core parts of the book, that relationship. First of all, Herman was an adored father figure to Joe when he was a little boy. And for many years, he idolized Herman. He wanted to be like Herman. And when Herman went out to Hollywood, which was 1926, and right before sound came in, by the way, he went out to do titles. They're the titles in the movies where they have the dialogue. He was a success. Paramount hired him for $400 a week, plus I think it was $2,000 bonus for every movie he got produced, with a minimum guarantee of four. So from somebody making $80 a week at the New York Times, he was in high cotton, or whatever they would have called it then. When Joe came, all of them graduated from college at really young ages, and Joe was dying to go out to Hollywood. So Herman brought him out in 1929 when Joe was not quite 20. And Joe just started at the bottom. Joe, I think Herman forced him to give him maybe $60 a week as a junior screenwriter or something like that. But Joe was an eager beaver, where Herman was laughing off what he was doing and expecting to go back to New York any minute. Joe was working himself into a frenzy, trying to answering any memo that, you know, call for suggestions and all that kind of stuff. So over time, and it was, well, I would say about 10 years, Joe did pass Herman. Herman was so dissolute, and Joe was a real go-getter. But and over that period, just as they would have become more brothers and less father figure slash brother, is when Joe passed him. And that, we can get very Oedipal about it and Freudian, et cetera, and examine what conflicts Joe had. But it was painful for Joe as well. And as far as Herman goes, my theory about oldest children is they experience the world with all these faces looking at them, and it's all about you. Joe was had sibling rivalry. Joe was competitive with Herman. Even though he admired him, he was competing with him. And I don't think Herman was particularly competing with Joe. When Joe surpassed him, he certainly had mixed feelings, but he was always also proud of him.
Was that also, do you think that he was just so mired in his own problems that he didn't really feel that, I mean, he had to compete? Because he didn't have the time to, or at all, or I mean, he was just.
Well, I think, you know, and I'm an oldest child. You sort of go along and live your life, and your siblings are just reacting to you. Mm-hmm. You're kind of oblivious.
Yeah.
He was somebody. He was very admired. And Joe used to joke, his tombstone would say, "Here lies Herm, I mean Joe." You know, he was this afterthought kind of person. And actually, I've been fascinated because the reviews of the book, there's much more space devoted to Joe. There's many more movies that are worth examining. He lived 30 years or 40 years longer, et cetera.
Right.
But the reviewers, many of them are quite obsessed with Herman, the person, and Citizen Kane. So I've kind of felt like, poor Joe. Let's look at Joe a little bit. Let's look at Joe. So Herman was not, he was just living, I would say he was just living his life with his own dissipations. But he also became a terrible burden on Joe, because the more successful Joe became, the more Herman relied on him to bail him out.
Yeah.
When he had terrible gambling debts, when he got fired, that was his third dissipation, drinking, gambling, and getting fired all over town.
Yeah.
That's Herman. But he was very endearing and very beloved too. I wouldn't want him to sound like a total loser.
Yeah. Well, I do want to say one thing about Citizen Kane that I'm very glad that you set it up early on, that Herman had, early in the book, you're setting it up with the anecdote of him having to write a favorable review of a not so great performance about these things that were in part of his life that would make it into the Citizen Kane script. Solidifying his role in the creation of that film.
Right. There were very autobiographical elements. And what was interesting is, you know, if you're looking at Herman rather than just looking at Orson Welles or just looking at Citizen Kane, it's interesting from an artistic view to see what Herman did with what happened to him, how he twisted it around and put it into Citizen Kane. So, yes, that is the big controversy. I guess it's the biggest controversy in the book. Who wrote Citizen Kane, and how much is Herman's biographer going to claim for Herman as opposed to Orson Welles?
Yeah, yeah. Well, did you...
And,
oh, go ahead, go,
go ahead.
Ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, Herman wrote a good part of the original script that remains, and a lot of the best dialogue is Herman's. That said, I would never say it's anything but Orson Welles' movie, and that it's iconic the way it is because of Orson Welles.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, there's tons of stories in Hollywood along the same lines of a brilliant script, making it into the hands of a gifted director who makes it come alive on screen. And that's
right.
I mean, ideally, that's the way it works, right? You know?
Well, the big Hollywood issue, though, is that the director gets all the credit.
Yeah.
But certainly now. I mean, it was different then. This was the studio system then. But Orson Welles was sort of in a class by himself, even at 25 years old. He was the boy wonder. And so a lot of attention was paid to the parts going into it.
The birth of the auteur theory and all that business.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned a moment ago, you talked about the career that Joe had even beyond Herman's passing, and that, you know, he did go on to have many more late in life great successes. Even his we're thankful that his last picture was a success with Sleuth with Michael Caine, and that, you know, he got nominated for
Olivier,
that too.
Right.
Yeah, and Olivier, and that I guess he just decided at one point that he was going to hang it up at that point.
Well, I don't think he thought he was hanging it up when he was hanging it up. He used to joke that the entire cast, he had the only movie where the entire cast got nominated for Academy Awards, that being Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine. And he was nominated and as best director. And by that time, he was very, very damaged from his experience with Cleopatra. I think he made four more movies after that. And Sleuth was the last one, and it was a triumph. It was a critical and box office success. And that was 1972. He was 63 years old. He lived another 20 years, mm-hmm. and he did not assume. His diaries say things like, why am I going on in something that's, I'm tired, it gives me no pleasure. But he did, and scripts and ideas and suggestions continued to come to him over the years. But he was paralyzed and depressed by being blocked. It was an awful 20 years. And from my great age, it looks even more tragic. If I'd written the book when I was 35, I think, okay, he's 63. He had a good run. But now I see he had a lot more to give had his psyche not been so damaged,
yeah,
his spirit broken.
And we see lots of directors continuing to do great work into their 70s, mm-hmm, 80s, and it's beyond sometimes.
Right, right. And in fact, Billy Wilder kept going, and Joe, he felt that Joe and others felt this too, was so afraid of failure. And Billy Wilder kept going, and okay, if I fail, maybe I still have time to do another one, and that failure is not going to define me. But it scared Joe, that public humiliation from Cleopatra. And he never really got his confidence back.
What did he, in those last 20 years as well, beyond professionally, what did he, how did he think back on his own family history and legacy during those last years of his life?
Well, I think he'd say he wanted to write a book. Not occasionally people would come to him wanting him to write his memoirs, but he had this idea that he was going to do a history of the theater. He had ideas he would write. These are books he imagined himself writing, not to mention plays. Or I'll write a history of actresses. He was always fascinated by actresses. That meant theatrical actresses, by the way, and going back about 400 years. He was very intellectual. But he was so blocked. Alex Mankiewicz, his daughter, says he couldn't even write a Christmas card. Mm-hmm. It was so, and I quote a few of his diary entries, went down to the office, couldn't write. I mean, it was just sad. And then he got resentful at the kind of movies like a Mel Brooks movie. Go, well, I could never have used those words then. And if I could say those words, then, you know, I could have all kinds of prizes. He also pretended that he didn't care about honors and prizes, which, and he cared very much. And in those last years, especially in the 80s, I would say, he was honored at various film festivals. And so I call one of the last chapters Honors But No Dough. He put that in his diary. He was worried about leaving his wife and daughter provided for. And he goes, you know, plenty of honors, but no dough in sight.
Yeah.
So it was a really sad ending.
Well,
but at the very, very end, he did have an epiphany, and he finally realized, oh, yeah, I really did leave the world with some wonderful movies, and they've probably entertained more people than they would have, than a sort of mediocre book that I might have written did. So he finally, and this was, I would say, a few months before he died, came to that peace. So at least he died in peace, but it was a very sad story of his last 20 years. That's a lot of lost time.
Growing up in San Antonio, were you a fan of film at all? Have you been that way? And you, again, just to go back to that question of, this is your, you know, moving into Hollywood, but coming from the biography approach.
Right.
Were you a movie fan, a film fan growing up?
Well, I can't imagine anyone not loving the movies. I mean, it's just a wonderful, wonderful medium. And when I came to write this, you know, it was sort of, okay, how many of these movies have you seen? And how many of these movies did you see when they came out? And while I had seen some of them as an adult, the only one I remember seeing as a child was Cleopatra, mm-hmm, when I was a teenager, because I wouldn't have been allowed to see any of those movies growing up. But so they're period pieces. But the wonderful thing about Joe's movies, like No Way Out, is about race. Almost no movies in the early 50s were about race. And anytime anyone is portrayed who's not Caucasian, it's embarrassing and humiliating and horrible. And his movie, which was Sidney Poitier's major film debut, lasts. I mean, it really holds, and it's very impressive, and it made me very proud of Joe in that way. All About Eve, obviously, that's a major work, but A Letter to Three Wives portrays a working woman in a positive way, a woman who's trying to have a career and a home life, and that doesn't happen in a lot of the 50s movies. So it's interesting in that way as a period piece. I was not necessarily getting those messages. That was 1949. I was 2 years old, but now I can appreciate them.
And when was the last time you were back here in San Antonio in town?
Oh, well, I was supposed to come down for the book festival, which was too bad. So, I have a sister, Andy Stidell, and my brother David Ladinson is there part of the time, so I come to see them. I think I must have been there in 2019 because I like to come down, and my New York family likes to come down too. We love it. It's wonderful. I get off the I, when you used to get off the planes and walk out on the runway, that air hits you, and it really would set me back in time. Now it's when I walk out of the airport, but it's just a different feeling, and I love it. And I love San Antonio.
Excellent.